From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Friday, the 22nd of November, 2019, and we have an interesting show lined up for you today. We are going to get some different perspectives on the impeachment proceedings in Washington, which just had their third day in a row of testimony yesterday. Some really striking stuff from both David Holmes and especially Fiona Hill, two people who have worked in the government and were very close and involved and familiar with what was going on in terms of the Trump administration's dealings with Ukraine. And another person who was very much on the scene for the hearings anyway, was United States Representative Congressman Peter Welch, Democrat of Vermont, and he is a member of the House Intelligence Committee and was one of the folks asking questions of people like Fiona Hill and David Holmes and the other witnesses who've come before the committee in recent days. And I'm really happy to say he is our first guest here on the Dave Graham Show this Friday morning. Congressman Welch, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And I wanted to check in with you first to just get your headline. Where do you think we are? What kind of shape is all of this in?
Well, this all goes back to the beginning when President Trump had that phone call with President Zelensky. And he explicitly asked President Zelensky for a favor. And that favor was to provide an investigation on the Bidens that would help President Trump in his 2020 campaign. And that's an abuse of power. And all of the witnesses who testified, from the first witness, Ambassador Taylor, to the last witnesses, Mr. Holmes and Dr. Hill, have all confirmed that there was a concerted effort on the part of the president, particularly with Rudy Giuliani and this Ambassador Sondland, to pressure Ukraine into agreeing to do that political work for the president. And the tools they had was the dangling of a White House meeting for President Zelensky, which was really important to Ukraine, who was being attacked and is in a hot war with Russia. And the president withheld about $400 million in military aid that was really essential for the defense of Ukrainian, the country. So that's it. It's really straightforward, and the biggest significant evidence was from the president's own words in that transcript of his conversation with President Zelensky. Hill and Holmes were two, I thought, extremely effective witnesses, but just elaborated on that connection between aid to Ukraine, a White House meeting, and the requirement that Ukraine do political dirty work for the president.
Well, you know, I one of the things that's happening here, of course, is that there is this alternative competing narrative out there, which is being promoted by Republicans like Devin Nunes and Jim Jordan and others and a lot of folks in the sort of right-wing media sphere. If you follow online services like Gateway Pundit or Town Hall or even seeps onto Fox News sometimes. And that's this idea that that the real bad actor in the 2016 election was not Russia, but was Ukraine, and it really what we should be doing is investigating all of that as opposed to any of what the Mueller investigation looked at, which was of course Russia's alleged role in 2016, and the new chapter of dealings with Ukraine. So my question is really, Fiona Hill had some things to say about that narrative yesterday. And do you think that she's going to convince anybody?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question because there's no basis to the theory that Ukraine was involved in the 2016 election. I mean, Fiona Hill said that was fiction. And Mueller did his complete investigation with the FBI, with the intelligence agencies, and it's absolutely certain that Russia had state-sponsored aggressive interference in our election. There's no evidence that Ukraine, as a state, interfered in our elections. There were some ambassadors who expressed a preference for Clinton over Trump, but that was true all around the world. People would make their expressions as individuals, and in some cases, it was probably inappropriate given their positions in office. but there's literally no evidence. And that's what Dr. Hill was talking about as fiction. Then you ask, will she persuade people or convince people? You know, we're in this world now, Dave, where everybody, a lot of people feel entitled to have the facts that suit their needs. And people like that are beyond, they're beyond convincing. They believe what they believe, and that's that. And anything that validates that belief just reinforces it. So it is a fiction, but the people who believe in that conspiracy theory, I'm not sure Dr. Hill or me or anyone else is going to be able to persuade them. Now, the second thing is that even if you want to believe that fiction, there's a question here about the president's conduct. I mean, if you want to go do the 2016 investigation like the president wants, which is a total waste of time in my view, it still doesn't excuse his behavior where he asked a foreign leader to meddle in our politics on his behalf. And it really goes to the heart of the emptiness of the defense that my Republican colleagues offered, because instead of addressing directly what the president did, asking Ukraine to help him in his election, they talk 2016, they talk hearsay, they talk misdirection, they attack the character of these public servants, but they don't in any way come close to addressing the words of the president when he's requesting, quote, a favor, and that favor is interference in our election on his behalf.
You know, it really strikes me. I mean, I think I thought Fiona Hill's testimony yesterday on this question of these competing narratives was just really quite powerful and on point. And let me see if I can pull it up here.
Just on that, by the way, let me interrupt here, because one of the points she made is that that fictional narrative helps Russia. I mean, Russia's agenda here, they wanted Trump to win. Okay.
Yep.
But even without that, having a, you know, they're betting on that the candidate to win, they also had as an objective sowing division and discourse in our country by spreading these conspiracy theories. And that's really damaging for a democracy. You know, one of the dilemmas we have in this modern social media age is the lack of an agreed upon set of facts. You know, in the past, in my days early in politics and all of us, in the days of, you know, the three news channels, you'd have real hard arguments, conservative to liberal to progressive, but people would have a more or less common understanding of what the facts were, and they'd be arguing what's the best way to address this problem or not. Now we don't have that, and that's what Russia's trying to exploit, and they do it by trying to stoke and so these conspiracy theories and create divisions among us. So leadership at the presidential level, one of the things that's really important is that our president try to help us understand things in a common way, even if we argue what's the best approach and try to address that problem.
Yeah, I actually think this is one of the prime issues facing our society today in terms of, you know, sort of can this project called the United States of America last? And that is this idea that we can't even agree on what we're debating about. Never mind. I mean, as you put it, in earlier times, we used to have some pretty tough debates sometimes. But if you can't agree on what you're debating about, you're really in deep trouble in terms of trying to do any sort of public discourse for which democracies have been known up until this time.
Well, that's right. And that's something that I find very alarming about the president, because he's stoking this conspiracy theory about Ukraine, CrowdStrike. I mean, he's saying Ukraine, the CrowdStrike thing, he's saying Ukraine has the Democratic National Committee server. There's no evidence for that, but he keeps saying it.
Yeah.
And it means that everybody is just wrapped around an axle, not coming to some understanding. And obviously for him, it's a diversion. Because basically he got caught with this request for Ukrainian aid in his election.
The Fiona Hill is the, let's see, a former senior director for Europe and Russia at the National Security Council, very much an insider in the national security apparatus, at least up until recently. And her comment yesterday was, I thought, very striking. She said to the committee, based on questions and statements I have heard, some of you on this committee appear to believe that Russia and its security services did not conduct a campaign against our country, and that perhaps somehow, for some reason, Ukraine did. This is a fictional narrative that has been perpetrated and propagated by the Russian security services themselves. And so basically, when Jim Jordan, who, you know, one would think, I used to think of the Republicans as really being the more sort of flag-waving, into patriotism kind of party. And when Jim Jordan and Devin Nunes make their remarks here, we're basically in a situation where they're telling Russia's story for it, aren't they?
That's my view. Yeah, they are. And that it suits their moment because they want to defend against the impeachment of the president. But so instead of dealing with the president's phone call requesting help from Ukraine, they perpetuate that CrowdStrike 2016 fictional narrative. That's definitely it's a tactic on their part.
We have a caller on the line. Let's bring Ann from Burlington. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning. I wondered if Congressman Welch and the other people in Washington have thought at all about censuring Donald Trump rather than impeaching him, because I think that needs less votes in the Senate, and I just don't know if it's worth looking at.
Peter Welch, what do you think about that, censure versus impeachment?
Yeah, no, it's a thoughtful question. Here's the problem for me on this. What the president did, I think it's very grievous because he used the high position of public trust to essentially extract something that was personally beneficial to him. And, you know, I made an analogy. Let's say the mayor of a city did not agree to submit the police budget unless the police chief agreed to do an investigation on a political opponent. We'd all say that's wrong, and we'd be up in arms about it. The president isn't even admitting what he did. He's not even admitting that in that phone call he was making that kind of request. So he's in full denial mode. And the other thing is that he did this. He made this request to Ukraine to interfere in our election the day after that. He did it on July 25th. That was the day after July 24th when Director Mueller testified before Congress that Russia had, in fact, interfered in the 2016 election, and he feared that would be the new normal. And President Trump, the day after, asked for interference in the 2020 election. So when he's in such denial, won't even acknowledge what he did, and when you have no confidence that he's learned his lesson and is not making any indication that he's going to change his behavior, it makes going to censure much more difficult to consider. But I appreciate that thoughtful comment from the caller.
The other thing that occurs to me about the idea of censure is that if the House impeaches the president and the case goes to the Senate and the Senate does what's expected, which is to honor the fact that it has a Republican majority and probably would not have 67 votes to support impeachment and removal, and to support the impeachment and removal from office, or I should say, support the conviction of the president and removal from office, it would still be a big black eye for the president. There have not been many presidents who have been impeached in American history, and a censure is really a black eye for the president. So in terms of the actual practical political impact, it seems as though those two, either one of these moves would pretty much be of the same result, wouldn't they, Congressman?
You mean censure versus impeachment?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, here's where I'm at on this. I think impeachment is very, very divisive. There's just no way around it.
Mm-hmm.
But at a certain point, it becomes constitutionally essential. And that's where I've landed on this.
Yeah.
You know, the Ukraine is such an egregious breach of trust that do we condone it? Do we ignore it? I don't think we can. And especially where you have the president is totally denying what is completely obvious of what he did. Does a slap on the wrist where he's not even acknowledging he did anything wrong. I don't think that works, but I understand the argument. What's going to happen down the line, I just don't know. Mm-hmm. But a lot of us who were slow to come to impeachment, including Adam Schiff, including Nancy Pelosi, and I'd say me as well, and once we got there, we think it really is our obligation, it's our duty. The Constitution does create this impeachment remedy, and these are extraordinary circumstances where I think it's appropriate for us to proceed. But I hear that argument on the lesser sanction.
One more question related to Russia, and then I think I'm going to try to let that go because it's, boy, I mean, you could talk about it all day, really, but one of the things that has troubled me about this whole story of the phone call to the Ukrainian president by the president of the United States and this request that they come up with some dirt on the Bidens, it seems that whole move seems really rather petty. And I have wondered sometimes, and I want to get your thoughts on this, is the big prize here really just pleasing Vladimir Putin? Because this president has done so much other stuff to please Vladimir Putin, whether it's trying to weaken NATO or whether it's a sudden removal of U.S. troops from Syria or whether it you know, now in this case, obviously, to weaken the U.S. relationship with Ukraine would be, you know, and I wondered whether the president wanted to get into a little game here where he would constantly be dangling the White House visit and the military aid and that Ukraine would never be quite doing enough to investigate the Bidens to make him happy and to make those two things happen. And meanwhile, you know, Russia would have much freer rein in Ukraine. What do you think about all that?
Well, I think two things. I think number one, the president had two objections. That's the two things. Number one, he really did want that investigation to be announced on the Bidens. And then that was going to allow him to be trashing Joe Biden throughout the campaign. He saw Biden as his biggest rival at the time. Biden was the front runner, not necessarily the case now, but it was then, and it was the opponent that Trump feared the most. He wanted that investigation to be announced. But second, he is a Russian sympathizer. There's no question. Trump likes Russia. He likes Putin. And you saw in Gordon Sondland, in his describing that phone call he had with the president and then talking about it afterwards, he said Russia, the president doesn't care about Ukraine. He just doesn't care.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone else cared. In the David Holmes asked, what did he care about? Just big stuff. And the big stuff was things that affected him, like the investigation. And David Holmes pointed out, well, there's big stuff here. Ukraine is at war with Russia.
Yeah.
And the president didn't care. And that's more or less what Fiona Hill was saying. So the president, A, didn't care about the Ukraine. So that goes to your point. He was quite fine with Russia taking over Crimea. He said, from what I heard, I don't know if you remember this in the Hill testimony, but she said the president had said publicly that he thought a lot of people in Crimea preferred to be with Russia. He was basically condoning that investigation. So your point about Russia and Trump wanting to please them, I think, is totally valid. But don't underestimate how focused President Trump was on getting Ukraine to do its bidding on the campaign dirty work.
A couple callers on the line. Let's see if we can sneak at least one in right now. I've got Ruth from Sheldon. Good morning, Ruth.
Yes. Most people in the United States know that Russia tried to hack into the election. That's not unusual. We admit it. Where in the transcript does it say that President Trump wanted dirt on Joe Biden? There's nothing in the transcript that says that. Now, I already spoke to Dave Graham. I don't know if he remembers this or not, but I said it was laughable that Trump was worried about Biden being his opponent. That's just laughable. Biden is not even probably going to be the one who gets the primary. And I think you're totally out of touch with how the American people are viewing this. We're very angry. It's a total waste of money and a waste of time.
All right, Ruth.
Thank
you for the call. Congressman Welch, you know, I think that is a sentiment that I'm hearing some out there, and I suspect it's not as common in Vermont as it is in some other parts of the country, but certainly there are a lot of folks out there who are feeling like there is a significant a waste of time, as Ruth put it, going on here.
Right.
Defend this whole procedure to her.
Well, two things. One, people are frustrated, and I'm frustrated. You know, I'd much prefer to be focused on bringing down the cost of prescription drugs. We're going to take that legislation up soon. I'd much prefer to have a big infrastructure bill. I'd much prefer to be making college education much more affordable. And even though impeachment is getting a lot of the press focus now, we are working on those issues, because those really do make a difference in the lives of everyday people. So in that respect, Ruth, I'm doing everything I can to try to address these practical issues. But you said, where does it say it in the transcript? In the readout of the call, and, you know, it's available on the Internet, President Trump explicitly says to President Zelensky, I have a favor. And the favor is he wants him to do these investigations. And he mentions very specifically Joe Biden and Hunter Biden in CrowdStrike. So it's the president's own words in the transcript, and it's right there. Now, whether Biden will or won't be the nominee at that time that the president was making that favor request, Biden was the front runner. You may be right about Biden, but I think it's very clear that President Trump saw him as his major potential rival at that point, and did specifically mention Hunter Biden and Joe Biden.
All right, let's go to another caller. Belinda from Plainfield, I believe, is on the line. Good morning. Do we have Belinda from Plainfield?
I'm a progressive from the left wing of the Democratic Party. And I guess my question is, do you think it's wise for the Democrats to over-focus on the Ukraine scandal and Russiagate at the expense of everything else? I kind of feel like the Democrats have gone about this the wrong way, that there was a million other things that if we could have let the American people decide by putting it all out there on the table. The Democrats spent all of these years ranting and raving and yelling about how unfit for president he was, and then we had to drag Nancy Pelosi kind of kicking and screaming just for this Ukraine scandal, which I don't think necessarily resonates.
Linda, I got to cut you off because we're about out of time. I'm sorry, but it's an excellent question, and I think it really comes down to Congressman Welch. Do you think that we ought to be talking about the Emoluments Clause, all the issues of obstruction of justice in the Mueller investigation, and these other matters as well?
Well, unfortunately, I don't think we can avoid it. Not with what the president did. I do think here's where I'm in agreement. In addition to this impeachment inquiry, we've got to be focused on the everyday responsibilities of meeting the needs of citizens.
We got to get done with this sometime.
All right.
Hey, yeah. Congressman Welch, speaking of getting done with it, I hate to cut you off, but we got to go to a bottom of the hour break, and I promise you only to keep you to 9:30, and we're about there. So I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you soon. We are going to be back with more of the Dave Graham Show following our bottom of the hour break, folks. Stay with us.
Here at the Warren Store, we're kicking off the holiday season with our first ever added value gift card program. From Black Friday through Cyber Monday, 4 days only, we'll be offering 15% added value to gift card purchases that can be used for anything at the store. Stop by the store, call, or order online and make life easier for yourself and give the gift of splurge at the best one-stop shopping store in Vermont. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Got a little time for some open phone lines here. Our old friend Bob Ney is going to be joining us at about the quarter hour, quarter of 10 o'clock this morning. Bob, of course, was a longtime correspondent with Talk Media News. They've had a little shakeup down there. We don't know exactly what the future of our dealings with Talk Media News will be, but Bob's freelancing these days, and he has agreed to join us weekly on the Dave Graham Show here. Really happy about that, because I think he was actually, while he was doing the Talk Media News thing, he was pretty much, from what listeners told me, the favorite of our Talk Media News correspondents who would be joining us every morning after the 10 o'clock news. Today he's going to be before the 10 o'clock news. He's going to be joining us at around, as I mentioned, quarter over 10 of the hour, and we'll be having a few minutes with our good friend Bob. He's an interesting guy. He actually served in Congress for a while, and he got caught up in that Jack Abramoff lobbying scandal, ended up going to federal prison himself for a while in connection with that, and he's now out and doing some commentary. He's a Republican. He works hard at being pretty middle of the road, I think. He's a very thoughtful and insightful guy, and I really am happy to say that we're going to be having him back on the show. I guess weekly is going to be the new deal with Bob, and starting today. And what a day! What a day! We need all the Washington commentary we can get on this program that is going to be devoted entirely to the impeachment hearings that have been going on in the U.S. Capitol in recent days, last week and this week. Wow, what a story! It's been an amazing. I was actually off the last 3 days because WDEV was offering live coverage of via CBS, of course, live coverage of the impeachment hearings in Washington right through the Dave Graham Show last Tuesday, Wednesday, this week's Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. But boy, I couldn't do much on those three unexpected days off because I was glued to the TV and the radio and just listening in on the various media sources about this whole episode in American history. It's been quite something. Boy, we got the callers lined up on the lined up with us. I'm going to give the patience award to Fred because he actually called in before the break. Fred from Newbury joins us right now. Good morning, Fred.
Hey, morning. You know, it's a perfect day here. It's a steel gray sky and the threat of ice and snow. Classic Vermont.
Uh-huh.
So anyways, I'm looking at Mayor Bloomberg, and he's a very successful capitalist. And he seems to know how to run a city, or did. And I think that he, Bloomberg, could save the Democratic Party from the far left. What do you think, Dave?
I don't know. The Democratic Party is in a weird place right now. Because it's kind of the timing isn't great. Let's put it that way. To have this huge division in the Democratic Party, Bloomberg obviously is very much at the opposite end of the spectrum as far as Democrats go from, say, a Bernie Sanders or an Elizabeth Warren. Maybe that's the way the party needs to go. On the other hand, part of me says maybe they need to go hard left because, you know, the Republicans really in recent years have had quite a bit of success by going hard right. And sometimes, and I think the American people have found to some degree that refreshing. They have a really, really strong direction to their message, and it is hard right. And, you know, if you look at the members of Congress who were on that House committee, I mean, Jim Jordan and Devin Nunes and these other folks, they are the kind of up and coming Republicans in this country right now, and they're not messing around. They really want to. And you know, the party wants to eventually, one would think, get rid of Social Security, all of these New Deal programs and Great Society programs that presidents like Roosevelt and Johnson put in place, just basically reverse all of that. That seems to be, you know, where it's heading. And they don't seem that shy about it. Nobody's trying to keep it secret. Whereas with the Democrats, there is this real division within the Democratic Party itself about, you know, is it time to actually go to this agenda that the left certainly has dreamed of for decades, including nationalized health care, as Bernie Sanders used to call it. I guess it's called Medicare for All these days, including things like much reduced costs for higher education, any number of things, and obviously a very, very much more progressive income tax and. So on.
But I think the problem with the Democrats, they're not very good at arithmetic. I mean, with all these things they're talking about, where's the money going to come from?
The money's going to come from a tax on billionaires. That's right.
But the other interesting, nobody's talking about, even the Republicans don't talk about the national debt.
Uh-huh.
It's just unbelievable.
I think
the national debt's the biggest threat.
Yeah, I think the Democrats could put a message together along the lines of, here are our goals. We really would love to see Medicare for All, for instance, you know, within sometime in the not too distant, you know, next 10 years or something like that. We don't know exactly how we're going to get there, but that's the direction in which we want to go, folks. If they were to say that and then say, and we're going to really crunch the numbers hard and work hard on trying to bring this about, obviously they'd have a lot of political opposition on the Hill and from the insurance lobby and the pharmaceutical lobby and, you know, the medical lobby, basically. So it would not be easy. But if a Democratic candidate gets up there and says, I'm not going to stand here and promise you Medicare for All by 2024 right now, but I'm going to tell you my intention, my long-term goal is to bring that about in the United States. I actually think that could sell.
How can you have, I look at it, no, with a, we have such a large, heterogeneous country. How can you have Medicare for All when you got 300 people and you have all races and creeds and nationalities. I mean, how can you possibly do that?
Canada's a fairly diverse country. They've been doing it for a while.
We got 300 million people. Canada's got, what, 15 million? It's a big difference.
I think it's a little more than that. It's more like 40. But you know, I grant you that the United States is a much bigger country than Canada. Is that necessarily a barrier, or should the United States say, okay, we're going to do this in sort of regional healthcare systems? You know, there's going
to
be.
But it's a heterogeneous country. That makes a big difference. You go to Sweden, you go to Finland, you go to all those European countries,
yeah.
And they're not nearly as heterogeneous as we are.
Well, they're getting more so. And it'll be interesting to see how their social programs hold up. Hey, I got to get some other callers in, Fred. Thanks for the call. I always appreciate your thoughts and insights. Let's get Dave from Warren on the line here. Good morning, Dave.
So, I love your show. This is Dave and Warren.
Uh-huh.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, one of the issues which I think is being unraveled is really connected to the Russia, to Don Trump's businesses, emoluments, and everything that's been happening with Rudy Giuliani. And that has to do with the fact that Trump is unable to get legitimate bank financing for any of his projects. All of his financing really comes through, largely through the Deutsche Bank and other banks, where there has a loan guarantee, personal guarantee, by some of the Russian oligarchs.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way he can finance all these projects are with Russian money. So when you say, so he has to be friendly to those guys, otherwise he may get a foreclosure. So when Trump comes along and says, okay, why don't I get out of Syria, but I get the oil? Remember, he tried to pull that one off.
Yep.
And Russia says, okay, you get out of Syria, but you're not getting the oil. And then Giuliani says, we want to make a deal with selling natural gas to Europe and make a lot of money doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to get rid of the ambassador in order to pull this off. So the greed concept that those guys are pulling up is really sickening. And I'm hoping it's unraveled.
Dave, I get where you're going with this. I mean, I think that would be an obvious motivation for President Trump to try to cozy up to Russia, basically. And if you look at not just Ukraine, but if you look at the way he has beat up on NATO since coming into office and backed out of all these multilateral agreements that the United States was in, if you look at the sudden withdrawal from Syria, you know, there's a Russian flag flying over what until a month or two ago was a United States military base in Syria. And on and on. I mean, the list goes on of the things that you kind of look at this and scratch your head and say, why is our president trying so hard to please Russia? Now, people have come up with a whole lot of theories. You know, maybe they have something salacious on them. It's a blackmail thing. Maybe it is all just a financial thing. He wants to build his Trump Tower in Moscow and do these energy deals and so on. No one, I don't have a 100% sure sense of what the motivation is. But I think if you stack up all these facts, it just looks like somebody who is doing whatever he can to make Russia and keep Russia happy. So I get you that for sure. But
I think that's totally true, and so we have to cover that up.
Yeah,
he's even got the Supreme Court putting a delay on getting his taxes out there because his taxes will prove that he doesn't have any local financing.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, Dave, I got to get, but I appreciate the call. I think you're raising some good issues there. Let's see, do we have time? Just a couple minutes, maybe to squeeze a call in from Rama from Williamstown. Good morning, Rama. Rama, are you there? Rama seems not to
Hello?
Be there. Hey, is that Rama?
Yeah, I hope so.
Okay. Rama, what's going on?
All right. So anyway, I'm going to talk really fast on the time limit here, but I want to go back. You remember the national level organization, ACORN, not the state level?
Yes,
one,
I do.
Right?
Yep.
And how they were drummed out of existence based on a bunch of doctored outtakes from videos
mm-hmm.
that were passed around.
Yep.
And one of the big allies of the radical right-wing smear and lie machine at that time was Peter Welch, because he actively stood up and helped to attack ACORN at a national level, and he helped to do away from them. And their only crime was trying to get people who were politically disempowered to go out and register to vote. That was their sole crime. They did investigations all around the country. There were no criminal trials or convictions. As a matter of fact, one of my favorite examples out of that, how much of a lie that all was based on, was I remember the two who made the videos trying to go out and tell people how one Acorn worker in Brooklyn, New York, was telling one of their undercover people that she should bury money in her backyard to hide it from the IRS.
Rama, it's a little off our point this morning. I appreciate the call.
Dave, and it's not off the point.
Send me an email. We'll talk offline about it and see what's there. I got to get, but thank you. Thanks for the call. I'm really happy to say my next guest is a familiar voice on the Dave Graham Show, returning after a hiatus of several weeks, I guess it's been. Bob Ney joins us this morning. Bob, I'm sure you have been watching what's going on with these impeachment proceedings in Washington.
Yes, I have, Dave, and it's great to be back and hear your voice, your great show. And
right.
Yes, I've been watching, and a lot's happened in a few weeks.
Yes, it has.
It's wrapping up yesterday with the testimony of Fiona Hill, which I thought was fascinating. You know, when you look at the witnesses, too, and I did a lot of research on each witness that's been there the last few weeks, and you look at them, and they were either Republicans, Republican operatives, such as Sondland, when I say operatives involved in the political system, former ambassador to the EU, or current ambassador to the EU, and also people that were, you know, career diplomats. I really couldn't find a political activist per se on the Democratic side. So I just wanted to point that out. And so I think that their testimony was quite credible. Now, that doesn't mean that they all put a silver bullet out there, you know.
Yeah.
But obviously, when it, you know, you look at this and you see that something was unusual and something wasn't good, no matter which way you turn this thing, I thought the witnesses were fairly interesting and credible.
Well, let me ask you to and tell me if you don't want to do this. I don't want to too badly put you on the spot on your return engagement here, but you know, what would you say if you were really on the team with Jim Jordan and Devin Nunes? You know, you're a former Republican member of Congress. Mm-hmm. That's a fact. And you're sitting with them and you're trying to come up with the best defense to go out into the public with on the Dave Graham Show or on CNN or MSNBC or wherever and say, here's our case. What would you tell them?
Sure. I mean, that's a great question. I'm happy to answer because I was there in the last impeachment. And by the way, to make this basically, you know, not so political with my answer, the last impeachment, I was one of six people, including Lindsey Graham, who told the White House, if you admit perjury, we're not going to impeach. You can, you know, go your own path. Mm-hmm. I'm also on record that, you know, the president of the United States at that time, Bill Clinton, should not have been compelled to testify in a civil case. That's a fact of life. It's the legal part, you know, of the Constitution. But he was compelled, he was deposed, and he committed perjury. And based on that, not the sexual act, based on the perjury and the fact he wouldn't admit it and just get it out of the way, led to the, you know, to the impeachment. Now, on this one, if I were on your show and I was a, you know, local congressman representing your area, I would say that this is not something that was just nothing. This is not a pure witch hunt, although people from the beginning were trying to impeach the president. They said that.
Mm-hmm.
But that this doesn't look good. It's unusual. It doesn't smell good. It shouldn't have been done. President of the United States should never have mentioned anything relating to a political opponent, period. However, up to now, there hasn't been the silver bullet that Donald Trump called and we've got the recording or the factual statement that he said, okay, cut that aid until he does what I want. So therefore, it's close, but it wouldn't rise to the level of impeachment.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I guess that's one way
it's
to.
Close. It's close. So.
But of course, you'll notice that Nunes and Jordan are not doing that. They're not saying it's close. They're not saying it. You know, it just barely doesn't clear the bar or whatever for a vote for impeachment. They're saying that it's all a hoax. It's all, you know, it's all just a sham. Democrats have been out to get Trump from the beginning. Let me ask you about that charge that Democrats have been out to get Trump from the beginning. I mean, what's happened since the beginning? Before the 2016 election, Trump, according to the conviction of Michael Cohen, was involved in making payoffs to women who were possibly going to be speaking about his sexual escapades and so on, and including, you know, maybe other women talking about sexual assault. When I say escapades, I'm talking mainly about Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal. Right. So these payoffs happen out of campaign funds is what the allegation was. And if there's a violation of the law in terms of what the campaign finance law says, you know, if you break the law, maybe that's an impeachable offense. Yeah, and then so many other things involving the emoluments clause. You know, the president just seems to have no sense of this concern about how he's not supposed to make money off of being the president, and how his family members. I mean, this Hunter Biden thing strikes me as ironic on the family member front, because look at Jared and Ivanka and Don Jr. and, you know, why are they rich and famous, you know, and et cetera. I mean, there's so many things, other things. And in the Mueller investigation, which at least if it didn't uncover absolutely demonstrable collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, it did uncover and spoke out quite firmly about 10 or so instances of obstruction of justice. So, you know, they got Clinton on one obstruction of justice charge, right?
Yeah. Yes. Well, in perjury, you know, we got him on perjury, mm-hmm. but Clinton, by the way, had conducted himself in a totally different way during the impeachment. Now, I will tell you, the White House reached out to me during impeachment. The president's attorney called me. Mm-hmm. The president invited me over to the Oval Office at that time to have a very, very frank, honest conversation, you know, with him. Mm-hmm. So they did that, but they didn't fight it in the sense that they wouldn't do this. People couldn't. They didn't do that. President Trump's done that. The other thing is that I do think from day one, there have been elements within the Democratic Party. I can name you, for example, Maxine Waters, who came out before the president got his hand on the Bible and said impeaching. That happened. Not all the Democrats, but it did happen. So therefore, that kind of set a tone. They should have been honestly more careful about that politically. Now, having said all that, though, I think the mistake day one for the president was that he should have either had his family in the White House, which is okay to work there, but not in the business, but not both, because then you've got a Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton foundation situation, you know,
yeah.
Where you've got one part of you is in the government and one part of it in the, you know, the foundation, the private sector, et cetera. So I think the president made a horrible error on that. He got through the Mueller deal. And here's where I think it cuts to the chase. I think this was the personal psyche of the president of the United States of why he's in the jackpot seat again. And I'll tell you why. He had Rudy Giuliani, who, by the way, Dave, I think is the luckiest human being in the United States right now. Had he been called to testify, Rudy better get himself an attorney. I mean, he's just all over the place. But here was the thing about Rudy Giuliani was out there. This was set in motion. This wasn't us trying to pressure England to do something. The Ukraine borders Russia. They're up against the wall. They're a poor country. They would do anything. They would investigate anybody we wanted. But the president himself just had to get on that telephone. They didn't want him to. He had to get on there and do the art of the deal and cut the deal, or try to, or insinuate, or whatever he was doing, being involved in the deal himself. He didn't have to do that. He couldn't help himself.
Yeah.
And that's what got him. He's not gonna get convicted for it. And by the way, I don't think that, at least I can't say that he's going to lose his election. It depends on the opponent, but this surely takes the 20% undecided and makes some of them not so happy.
Yeah, it would be amazing to see an impeached president, which he is likely going to end up being, maybe not a convicted president, but an impeached president reelected to that office. So,
sure.
Hey, Bob Ney, I got to go, but I really appreciate you joining me this morning. Let's do it again next week.
Thanks.
All righty. Stay with us, folks. We've got more of the Dave Graham show to come after the 10 o'clock CBS News and a couple words from sponsors.
Here at the Warren Store, we're kicking off the holiday season with our first ever added value gift card program. From Black Friday through Cyber Monday, 4 days only, we'll be offering 15% added value to gift card purchases that can be used for anything at the store. Stop by the store, call, or order online and make life easier for yourself. and give the gift of splurge at the best one-stop shopping store in Vermont. The Warren Store, where funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We are back continuing our second hour today of our special coverage of the impeachment proceedings in Washington. We just had 3 days of testimony there, and we're all trying to sort out what we heard and figure out what's going on. And to help us do that in the next few minutes is Bill Rakoff of CBS News. Bill's been following this stuff very closely on Capitol Hill. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for joining us this morning. I wanted to check in with you and just find out, first off, we've been talking about this with other guests and so on for the first hour of the show, and I want to find out from you, what is the roadmap ahead looking like? Are we going to see more House Intelligence Committee hearings before it goes to judiciary, or are they going to try to bring in John Bolton, or are they going to try to bring in other witnesses, or are they pretty much done?
So here's what we don't know, and pretty much everything you just asked me is what we don't know for sure. But we do have a bit of a guideline as to what we think is going to happen. It is possible that the Intelligence Committee could take some more depositions, might even have another public hearing before they send the information together, after they cobble it together and send it over to judiciary. They are still in court fights with the administration over documents and witnesses, not the least of which are Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney. Bolton is a separate issue. He's outside of the government, but he's waiting to hear on another court case how a judge rules whether or not he should listen to the White House's ban or honor the congressional subpoena. So it is possible that they could wait, or that could happen, but we get the sense that Adam Schiff doesn't want to wait for that. They feel like they've got the evidence that they need now. So barring anything, I would think that they're probably going to spend the next week or so cobbling all that information together. They'll send it over to judiciary, and you're exactly right. Judiciary may hold a public hearing or two, but they're ultimately the ones who are going to take the vote on whether or not to move out to the full House a recommendation to file articles of impeachment against the president. And we think that'll happen before the end of the year.
Could the Judiciary Committee hold more fact-gathering hearings or depositions and then bring in Bolton, Mulvaney, or any of the other witnesses?
It's always possible, but they were trying to do this hearing and let intelligence do it. And one of the reasons you heard Republicans complain about the process, saying, why isn't judiciary doing this to begin with? They gave it to intelligence, Republicans say in part, so they could do the hearings and the depositions behind closed doors down in the skiff in the basement of the Capitol. And that way they said that, there wouldn't be any surprise stuff that gets out, that the Democrats don't want to have come out. That was a big charge by Republicans, something that Democrats and Adam Schiff continue to tamp down. So while there is that possibility for some hearings, and there's always the possibility more witnesses could come forward, the idea is to try to get this to judiciary sometime at the beginning of the month of December, have them get rid of it before they go on vacation. And if there is going to be an impeachment trial in the Senate, it would likely happen in the first half of January.
When do we expect actual impeachment votes on the floor of the House?
Like I said, I think that's going to come up here. They get out of town on December 20th. And by the way, they also have a big spending problem. They've got a continuing resolution that the president just signed into law yesterday that funds the government through December 20th. They've got to deal with that as well. Nobody wants to stick around here during the Christmas break. So I suspect you're going to see the action move pretty quickly, so that by the time we get down into the week of the 15th or something like that, that's probably when you're going to see a vote like that, perhaps even on the full House floor by then.
Senate trial, I hear, could take something like 2 weeks after the turn of the year.
Yeah, and again, it's quite possible that, it could go on a little bit longer. Republicans, some of the ones that we're hearing from, are saying, we don't need to drag this out on our end, and it seems as if the evidence has been pressed. There's a sense by all parties, Dave, that they want to get this thing done with, because two things are happening here. Obviously, they want to get back and legislate. They want to solve some of the problems, and the members want to get out and campaign. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to campaign while impeachment is still going on. They want to get that in the rearview mirror, both Republicans and Democrats, so that they can campaign free and clear on the results of it as they get farther into the year. And they think if they can get that done in January, that will leave them enough time to be able to focus on other issues.
All right. Well, Bill Rakoff of CBS News, I really appreciate you giving us a sort of a calendar here. I think this is something important people are going to obviously be following in the weeks ahead, and it's good to get a sense of what's coming. So thank you so much.
You got it. Thank you.
All righty. We'll talk to you soon. Eric Davis is a professor emeritus at Middlebury College in political science. And Eric's been a friend of this show in the past and is actually somebody he's been a go-to guy for me for a long time when I worked as a reporter for the Associated Press here in Vermont, which I did for more than 30 years. I would frequently call Eric to get his thoughts on whatever was going on in political news in Vermont, and I think today we're going to talk about the national picture since there's so much happening in Washington. Eric Davis, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Good morning, Dave.
Hey, I wanted to check in with you first just about a couple of things we've been talking about. That we're devoting the whole program today to this subject of impeachment and and this pause in the hearings. We don't know exactly. I was just talking to Bill Rakoff from CBS News, and he was saying it's possible the House Intelligence Committee, which has been conducting the hearings so far, could actually return and try to bring in some of the additional witnesses that people have talked so much about as not having been making themselves available yet, including John Bolton, the former National Security Advisor, Mick Mulvaney, the White House Chief of Staff, and others who obviously very, very close to the pinnacle of presidential power, the whole White House system. Should those guys suddenly have a change of heart and say, yeah, I want to go up and testify, there's a possibility of more hearings. And then, other folks are saying, well, no, unlikely. The Judiciary Committee, I'm sorry, the Intelligence Committee feels it has plenty of stuff stacked up and ready to ship to the Judiciary Committee, which, of course, makes the final recommendation to the full House as to whether we ought to vote for articles of impeachment. And Eric Davis, what's your bet? Do you think we're going to hear any more from the Intelligence Committee, or are they done?
Well, it seemed to me, on the basis of the hearings we've had so far this week, there are four or five witnesses who could provide useful information, but none of them will come unless the court orders them to do so.
Right.
Those people would be Mike Pompeo.
Yep.
John Bolton.
Mm-hmm.
Rudy Giuliani.
Mick Mulvaney.
Mike Mulvaney. So there's five people there.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the case of Giuliani, Trump will claim attorney-client privilege to prevent mm-hmm. him from testifying, and in the case of the other four, Trump will claim executive privilege. And there's a case pending in the U.S. District Court in Washington right now involving Bolton and one of his aides. Whichever way the lower court rules, the losing party will appeal to the Court of Appeals in D.C., and then whichever party loses in the Court of Appeals will appeal to the Supreme Court. So I think the issue the House has to think about is, you know, how long do they want to wait for the courts to make up their mind on this? It could very well be if it ends up with the Supreme Court and is fully briefed and argued that there wouldn't be a Supreme Court decision until sometime in the spring. Does the House want to wait that long, or do they want to go forward with what I think many people would consider at this point? You know, it's a record that points in a certain direction, but it's incomplete because there's a lot of questions that are still out there that these principals could provide more information on.
Yeah,
my guess at this point, Dave, is that the Intelligence Committee will probably forward their recommendation to Judiciary, which will probably bring articles of impeachment to the House floor sometime in December. But there are missing pieces in the evidence, and they depend on those high-ranking people.
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating question. I've actually thought. Really, since last spring, when it became apparent that this would eventually be a happening thing, you know, when Nancy Pelosi was impeachment fans were kind of accusing her of dragging her feet and et cetera, et cetera. I was telling people, you know, cool your jets, and I bet you that the Democrats in the House are going to time this thing to get it as close to the election as possible. And they're going to have some White House help because they're going to be able to point at the White House and say, hey, these people won't send us the documents. They won't send us the witnesses. And we're waiting for them to respond to our subpoenas. And so don't blame us if it seems to be moving slowly. OK,
well, I mean, there's a political issue here, too, which, you know, I don't know to what extent the House leadership is hearing from Democratic members of the Senate, but there's six Democratic members of the Senate who are running for president, and they would prefer to be spending January and February in Iowa, New Hampshire, and Tuesday states than sitting on the Senate floor listening to testimony about impeachment.
Oh, you know, five of those Senate Democrats are going to be available by next summer.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's so true. That's true. But it's the period between now and Super Tuesday,
yeah,
March 3rd, that's key.
Yeah, I actually, no, I mean, I think it actually fits my little program here that I'm drawing up where the delay, if you invite the White House to delay on the subpoenas and the, you know, et cetera, for a few months, you get most of the primaries out of the way, then you can re-engage late in the primary process or even, you know, or right around convention time or whatever, when people's attention is really shifting now to the national story of the 2020 election. And have these impeachment proceedings go into kind of their climactic weeks right during that you know, the summer start to the fall general election campaign.
Yeah.
I'm being a little cynical here, Eric, but I mean, I think
there's another very interesting issue here, which probably is purely speculative, because yep. At this point, I think it's doubtful that there would be a two-thirds majority in the Senate to remove Trump.
Yeah.
But the impeachment clause of the Constitution says that someone who is convicted of an impeachable offense is removed from office and then is ineligible for any further office under the United States.
Yeah, that's right.
Just playing that one out. You know, if hypothetically Trump were impeached after the filing deadline for the general election in many states, he's ineligible to run, but his name is on the ballot.
Right. That's
so.
That's, yeah, that would be. I don't think
we're going to get to there, because I don't think there's going to be a two-thirds majority to convict.
I concur.
It is interesting to note that the Constitution says that someone who is impeached is also ineligible for any future office under the United States.
Wow. You know, I hadn't thought of that, but that is that is a fantasy scenario, I'm sure, for a lot of Democrats. And I think the more likely outcome, of course, as you say, is that the Senate would not muster the two-thirds, 67 votes to remove the president from office. Okay, so he's not convicted. He can go around saying he's exonerated or totally exonerated or whatever. That'll be his story, and there'll be a heck of a lot of a record on the other story, but I was just going to say the Democrats are then going to be in what I would think would be very good shape in all of their Senate and House races around the country. If you're running against Jim Jordan in Ohio, or Devin Nunes in California, or you know, Mitch McConnell in Kentucky, you're gonna have a big campaign speech to give about, you know, or get up in a debate with these guys and say, you know, we used to think the Republicans were tough on crime. Why are you coddling a criminal?
Well, I mean, I think there's some districts where that argument is going to work, and some where it won't. You mentioned Jim Jordan and Devin Nunes. I think they're in pretty safe Republican districts, no matter what happens. But Mitch McConnell is a more interesting question, because polls out of Kentucky indicate that his reelection is too close to call. Most of the national political analysts put that race in either toss up or very slightly Republican. So Mitch McConnell's going to have to work hard for his reelection. And there's some other Republican senators who are right on the fence, too, in terms of reelection. Susan Collins from Maine.
Yep.
Cory Gardner from Colorado. There's Arizona is going to be a close Senate race. Alabama is likely to be a close Senate race. That's Democrat held. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't think McConnell wants to get into a point where, however the impeachment proceeding plays out, you know, even assuming it ends up in Trump not being convicted, McConnell doesn't want his Senate majority put in jeopardy by the way the impeachment process plays out. But on the other hand, the House basically at this point controls the timing of it.
Yeah.
Just one other point, too. I mean, the Supreme Court can make a decision quickly when it needs to. I mean, there's examples in the past of them turning a case around in less than a month when they've had to.
Bush versus Gore.
So, yeah, Bush versus Gore being the best example of all. Exactly. That mm-hmm. one was resolved in about 3 weeks. So, you know, depending how the lower court, I mean, I did see one news article that said that the judge in D.C. said he thought he'd have a ruling next week on the case brought by Bolton and his associate. So, you know, it's possible that the Court of Appeals could decide that case. The D.C. Circuit could decide that case early next year. And the Supreme Court could make a decision, I think, by sometime, say, the end of March.
Right. I think that could be that's still, you know, right in the middle of the primary campaign. And that strikes me as a bit of delay here. I mean, I think this process is going to unfold not by Christmas, maybe by Easter, more likely to, in my book, by Memorial Day.
I mean, I can see an argument where some people would say to the House, you know, make your very best legal argument as to why these people should be compelled to testify. I mean, the argument would be something like the impeachment investigation is something that is in the power of Congress under Article 1 of the Constitution. Trump is going to claim executive privilege under Article 2. This is a perfect sort of question for the court to act as the sort of the referee between an Article 1 power and an Article 2 power and deciding what the balance of interests is. Yes, it will take a bit of time for the briefs to be written and the oral argument, the justices to consider and do their research and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But considering the fact, at least in my opinion, that there are still many questions out there, the testimony of these second level officials was all very useful and compelling, and it presented a consistent story. But there's a lot of gaps still too, involving in particular the extent to which Trump was personally directing this entire, let's call it, rogue foreign policy operation vis-a-vis the Ukraine.
Yeah. What do you think of that phone call from the restaurant in Kiev to the president? Does that help?
Well, I mean, it's obviously very damaging to the president. Now, he went on Fox News this morning and said that call never took place. He said some other things, too, in the call with Fox News. He said, quote, if it wasn't for me, Hong Kong would be obliterated in 14 seconds or something like that. I don't know what that means. I think that the
Fox News conversation with the president raises a really interesting question here. I want to cover this in our last few minutes together here, Eric. It goes like this, and it's, I'm going to be putting it roughly because I'm just sort of making it up as I go. But I saw an article in BuzzFeed yesterday where it sort of was an analysis of a lot of the reporting that's been going on right-wing media sites like Gateway Pundit and Town Hall and these other places. And I check these sites out myself from time to time just to sort of see what they're up to and so on. And there really does seem to be a pretty well-developed, I don't mean to say I lend it much credence, but you know, it's well-developed in terms of how a writer's next novel is coming or something. a counter-narrative about Ukraine 2016 and all of this kind of thing. And there are a lot of people around the country who are looking very, very hard for, they seem emotionally attached to a desire to believe all of that, right?
Well, yeah, and my sense, listen, I mean, Fiona Hill talked about this yesterday in her testimony. She said that basically this story that somehow Hillary Clinton's server ended up in Ukraine, or that Ukraine was responsible for hacking into the DNC emails, that's all Russian disinformation. And Hill went on at some length to talk about the interagency investigation that took place that confirmed in the minds of those who conducted it that Russia was actively involved in a disinformation campaign in the 2016 presidential campaign.
17 U.S. intelligence agencies concurred,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And basically what Fiona Hill was saying is that the Republicans either deliberately or out of foolishness are continuing to swallow Russian disinformation campaigns. And, you know, the way she put it, you know, she didn't put it in these words, but Vladimir Putin is sitting in his office in the Kremlin watching all this and just rubbing his hands with glee.
Yeah. I shouldn't laugh, but my God.
And she knows. I mean, she is one of the leading experts on Putin. Before she went into the White House, she wrote a very good book about Putin.
Yeah, who was it? I think Michael McFaul, the former ambassador to the Soviet Union, also wrote a book about Putin and says hers is better than his. So that's a nice compliment when you yes. when you get it from a, you know, theoretically competing writer. Here's the quote from Fiona Hill yesterday that I thought was so powerful. I've already read it once on the show, but it bears repeating. Based on questions and statements I've heard, some of you on this committee appear to believe that Russia and its security services did not conduct a campaign against our country, and that perhaps somehow, for some reason, Ukraine did. This is a fictional narrative that has been perpetrated and propagated by the Russian security services themselves. I just think that sums it up pretty tightly, doesn't it?
Yeah. And in terms of, you know, the news sites you were referring to, I think one of the things that I find most fascinating now that's going on is there seems to be this increasing sort of division in Fox News between there are legitimate journalists who work for Fox News, people like Chris Wallace or Shepard Smith, who just left.
Brett Baer, maybe.
And then there's the opinion shows on Fox News, Hannity and things like that, and Fox and Friends in the Morning, which is also a lot of opinion.
I don't know what their holiday party is going to look like this year.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it'd be interesting to see, you know, how long will, I mean, Shepard Smith has left. How long are the other people who consider themselves journalists rather than commentators and opinionists, how long is the rest of them going to stay at Fox?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. You know, they seem to be on the fulcrum right now. That seems. I mean, I think Gateway Pundit, et cetera, are going to be in the tank with Trump. You know, right up to the final days. But Fox seems to be really tugged in a couple different directions right now, and that's fascinating. I don't know whether that's just, you know, Roger Ailes no longer being there to whip him into line or what it is. But yikes.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to follow that subplot in, as the weeks unfold and this story unfolds. I guess you can tell I'm kind of having fun. I think as a journalist,
yeah,
this is a blast. Eric Davis, that's got to wrap it up for us this morning, but I really appreciate you coming on with me this morning. Let's do it again soon, and thank you so much.
You're most welcome, Dave.
All right, going to the bottom of the hour, CBS News, a couple words from our sponsors, and when we return, one more half hour to talk about impeachment. My guest is going to be former Republican gubernatorial candidate David Kelly. We'll be back.
Here at the Warren Store, we're kicking off the holiday season with our first ever added value gift card program. From Black Friday through Cyber Monday, 4 days only, we'll be offering 15% added value to gift card purchases that can be used for anything at the store. Stop by the store, call, or order online and make life easier for yourself and give the gift of splurge at the best one-stop shopping store in Vermont. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We are back and continuing our conversation this morning about the impeachment hearings that have been unfolding in Washington. More to come. We were talking with Bill Rakoff of CBS News back at near the top of the hour, and Bill was saying, laying out a little bit for us what the calendar is expected to look like in this whole imbroglio in the coming weeks and possibly months. And the question right now is, it's not 100% certain whether the House Intelligence Committee, which has been chairing or hosting the hearings in the past couple of weeks, will continue with that and try to bring in additional witnesses, including some very senior administration officials. John Bolton, well, he's former National Security Advisor, White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, perhaps Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. None of them has testified as yet in front of the House Judiciary, any of the committees in the House, actually, on these questions that are being asked about President Trump and his conduct. And that's a big gap in the eyes of many people. And so we're going to wait and see, I think, whether those folks are coming in at this stage or whether maybe when the House Judiciary Committee gets the case handed off to them by the Intelligence Committee, that then these witnesses would be the battles over their appearance that are going through the courts right now would be resolved and they would end up in the witness chairs, or perhaps they'll be among the witnesses coming in the Senate if the Republicans who were going to run that process believe they have some exonerating information. So we'll have to watch as it all unfolds. But my next guest I want to introduce, David Kelly, is longtime Vermont attorney, has been dabbling around the edges of politics in Vermont for a long time as well. He actually was the Republican nominee for governor in 1994. He has extensive experience in the Eastern Bloc. He was situated, spent some time in Moscow for a while, trying to launch a business over there during the time immediately following the dissolution of the Soviet Union. He's traveled in Eastern Europe, and so I thought he would be an excellent, have some excellent perspective to offer on this whole matter involving Ukraine, Russia, and so on. And David Kelly, thanks so much for coming in this morning.
Well, you know, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, Dave.
And so I guess the questions that's been bugging me the most about this whole case is I look at this call from President Trump to the president of Ukraine, July 25th, where he's allegedly asking about the trying to get the Ukraine to launch investigations into the Bidens and into Ukraine actually interfere in the 2016 election? Is there still a Democratic Party server, or was there ever in somebody's garage or basement or something in the Ukraine? Who knows? And there's that whole issue, which the Democrats have really hung their hats on in terms of this is the impeachable offense. The president has no business calling up a foreign leader and asking him to investigate a U.S. domestic political rival like Joe Biden. And that is just right there. We got him, basically. It seems to be the pitch. But I actually think that maybe what the president has really been about here is a bigger prize than just getting after Biden, than trying to do damage to a political rival in the United States. Because so much of this would actually help Vladimir Putin and Russia, that I think it's part of this long pattern of behaviors by President Trump that appear designed to help Russia. You know, there's now a Russian flag flying over a former U.S. military base in Syria. The president has gone out of his way at every opportunity to try to undermine NATO, something else Vladimir Putin would love to do. I mean, the list is long of instances in which people have been scratching their heads and saying, why is this president being so supportive of Putin and Russia? And certainly this behavior in Ukraine could be on that list, couldn't it?
Well, our foreign policy, especially with respect to Eastern Europe, from my perspective, has been seriously disappointing. I don't understand where much of it is coming from, and that phone call you mentioned is certainly a damning phone call. I spent a lot of time in the countries around Russia. I spent time in Yugoslavia before it imploded. I spent plenty of time in Hungary, countries that were invaded by the Soviets, and I spent plenty of time in Georgia, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, the Ukraine, and Moldova, and I understand how palpable fear is with respect to their neighbor, Russia, and certainly the behavior in the Ukraine and Crimea underscores some of that fear, and we can certainly understand Zelensky's request for those javelins and the need for them. And so to mix up personal politics with that kind of foreign policy imperative is disturbing. I also think that this process we're involved in, the process of impeachment, has such enormity of taking an election and reversing a democratic election is something that needs to be done with great care and caution. And I'm a lawyer. I've seen the indictment, but I haven't seen the trial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just to go back into this Russia question, though, which I think really deserves a lot of digging in. You mentioned the javelins. These are anti-tank weapons that the United States was going to be supplying and has been supplying to Ukraine. And apparently they're quite effective. The Russian troops actually fear them. They feel like this is a deterrent to actual a physical attack on Ukrainian soil. And the United States, the Ukrainians have been asking, when do we get more javelins? And President Trump is holding up this military aid, or was holding up this military aid until he apparently, at least in one narrative, got caught doing so and then said, okay, it can go. The president, though, has this sort of story about wanting an investigation of the Bidens. But really, what if the original plan on his part was to, or just what was going to unfold by instinct, which I don't know if he really has plans so much as just a day-to-day instinct. But what if what might happen would be that the Ukrainians would start investigating the Bidens, which have been done before, and they determined there wasn't anything there. And they come back and they say, yeah, we're looking into it again, Mr. President, but we're really not finding much there. And he's still dangling the military aid and saying, you are not going to get this military aid until you find me some real good dirt on the Bidens. Okay. Now, not getting the military aid to Ukraine benefits whom? Benefits the Russians, right?
Well, listen, our foreign policy with respect to Russia and Eastern Europe has troubled me since the Clinton administration.
Mm-hmm.
In the late 80s, the relationship between Gorbachev and Reagan had set a tone of such hopefulness and such possibility and such opportunity that it's one of the great tragedies of history that we have descended to this point. We had enormous opportunities, and I think the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, I think the Obama administration, and now this is one of the worst. I don't know if we can ever go back and repair to the point where we create some of the opportunities for democracy and trade that first showed up in the late 80s. But we've done we've made mistakes all along the trail, and this is some of the worst. And the fact that we have begun to involve personal political aggrandizement with the defense of countries like Ukraine is a damning indictment.
And if you look at the history's possible indictment of this, I don't think the history is completely written yet, but I think what you're describing here is a situation in which we've gone from Mr. Gorbachev tear down this wall to there's no quid pro quo.
But, you know, what we really need right now is an intelligent conversation on a big, much, much bigger subject. This telephone conversation as being the flashpoint of our discussion about our relationship with Eastern Europe and with Russia, to me it really diminishes the importance of that relationship and what needs to be done to fix it. We almost have to go back to where we were in the mid-60s. The relationship has deteriorated so badly. But we can do a great many things to make it better. That's just a long conversation, and it takes a lot of intelligence, and it takes people not just like Fiona Hill, but all kinds of people from Eastern Europe and from Western Europe, from the United States. We need to bring people together at places like the Center for International Studies at Harvard, and we need to say, you know, let's start talking about rehabilitating this relationship.
I have to agree. I really think this is very, very important stuff, and to have this president quoted by a top aide and his ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, who says that the president doesn't give a bleep about Ukraine. I think we've come to a very unfortunate pass here, and one which I think it's a sign of not understanding the gravity of the job of being president of the United States.
It's hard for me to disagree with that. I, of course, because of my own time in Eastern Europe and my own personal experience and my work at the Center for International Studies at Harvard, I feel particularly involved in that issue. But I think there are other issues like immigration and refugee policy that cry out for attention right now, that somehow are not getting the kind of intelligent dialogue and conversation that they demand. And quite frankly, I think to some extent, both parties have to accept responsibility here. The leadership, that there's been a failure of leadership with respect to our foreign policy when it comes to all of Eastern Europe. I don't think the Clinton administration, the Bush administrations, or the Obama administration has done a very good job, and this is the worst.
I think it speaks to the quality of our politics, basically, where pretty much let's just take the example of immigration for a moment, and obviously the flashpoint for immigration in the United States is the U.S.-Mexican border, and as soon as somebody on the Democratic side says, we need to sit down and actually figure out a policy here that works, that it has many moving parts and they all sort of fit together in one machine that implements a policy that actually is sustainable and makes sense. Fox News is going to start talking about the Democrats favor open borders. Well,
and you know what we need is we need George Aiken and Mike Mansfield sitting down and talking to each other.
Yep.
We need to break this mentality of adversity that we've created. Otherwise, we're going to get nowhere. But I feel like we have to look at ourselves, Democrats and Republicans, and accept responsibility collectively, because the conversation has become so polarized, it's fruitless.
Dave Kelly, one last topic I really want to dig into with you a little bit is this problem of competing narratives. The stories being told, there seem to be two main ones. One being told by all these witnesses who just came in front of the House Intelligence Committee in the last couple of weeks. The other being told by Devin Nunes and Jim Jordan, the two Republican Congress, Elise Stefanik from right across the lake in New York State, are pushing this idea that somehow there's a whole different story of what has happened, what has transpired in international politics, I guess you call it, in the last few years. It wasn't Russia who interfered in the 2016 election. It was Ukraine. There's still a Democratic Party server in Ukraine somewhere. Joe Biden and Hunter Biden were big players in corrupting Ukraine and being corrupted by Ukraine. The whole counter-narrative that the Republicans have been trying to push here. And if you look at some of the online comments, if you look at some of the people who call into the show here, people are buying it. And
I think, Dave, you raise a really complex question, because if you go back 50 or 75 years, when the central source of information was Walter Cronkite and Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
And Dan Rather, perhaps. Cronkite, yeah, all those guys.
There was essentially one story.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't always 100% correct.
Yeah, yeah.
Now we're in this digital revolution. And I think to some extent we're lost in the jungle and we're trying to find our way out. But media literacy and sifting through the oceans of information that we're swimming in today has created an enormous challenge for democracy. And that's one of the conversations that we need to be having that we're not having. I'm not sure in the end that it's bad, because I think having access to more information and more ideas and more debate and a free marketplace of ideas ultimately is good. But we haven't found a path through this new digital revolution, and it's confusing.
Yeah, we had an election in 2016. A foreign country meddled in our election in that year. It's widely agreed. We don't have agreement in this country as a general proposition, whether the foreign country that meddled in our election was Ukraine or Russia.
I think we do.
All 17 U.S. intelligence agencies say it was Russia. Fiona Hill called the Ukraine version a fictional account yesterday in her testimony to the House committee. And then there are a lot of commentators out there online and elsewhere saying that Fiona Hill is some kind of an evil person or something. And mainly for saying that, for coming and saying, sorry, folks, but that's a fictional account.
And you know something? We live in a free society and we have free speech, and people have to be educated and intelligent enough to sort through the wheat and the chaff.
Okay. Let's get a caller just a couple minutes to go here. If Joe could be quick. Joe from Bristol.
Yes. Good morning. Good morning to your guest. You know, I would think that when you do have accusations of crimes committed and so forth, now, I think I heard this somewhere else. I don't think it's an original thought. But you have to have a victim. So if Donald Trump did all these nefarious things, whatever they might be, there has to be a victim in this if they go to trial.
Would Joe Biden be a victim of that phone call if it resulted in a spurious investigation?
Would he be a victim?
Yeah.
He could possibly be.
Would the American people be victims of that phone call if it resulted in an election result being skewed? And having bad information as they go into the polls?
Well, you'd have to have who it was directed at, which would be Ukraine. It wasn't directed at the American people.
Oh, it was absolutely directed at the American people.
It would have to be proven.
The whole allegation is that the president wanted an investigation.
It would have to also be proven that it was directed at Joe Biden.
Yeah.
And it would have to be proven that it was directed at the president of the country.
So the president's on a phone call saying, please investigate the Bidens. I'd say that was directed at Joe Biden, right?
No, I'm not judging whether Joe Biden or Donald Trump is guilty. I'm just telling you that in a court of law, you have to establish the victim.
Got it. Okay, thanks, Joe. I got to go, but thank you for the call.
I'm not taking sides.
I got it. Thank you for the call, and we're going to call it a day because we're coming up to the top of the hour here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. What a week it's been, folks, and I really want to thank you all for listening in. My guest has been, in the last half hour, Dave Kelly. Thanks so much for stopping by, Dave.
Always a pleasure.
Eric Davis, Bill Rakoff, Bob Ney, and Peter Welch earlier today. I thank all my guests for coming in. Hey, folks, have a great weekend. It's been a really wild ride here. I think it'll continue. We'll be back on Mondays, and join us again for another edition then of the Dave Graham Show.